We are living in a time when people are becoming more and more isolated. While they think they're more connected, quote unquote, in reality, we're losing very real connectivity with one another. Even prior to the COVID lockdown, you know, people would routinely drive to work alone in their car. They work all day in their office or their cubicle. We got cash from an ATM. It was just quicker and easier and more convenient. We'd go to a drive-thru to grab lunch. People would go home, often each to their own room to watch something on television because, you know, we can't agree on what we want to watch, so everybody watches whatever they want to watch. We tend to just isolate ourselves from one another. People don't get together to visit. People would, you know, it's so convenient now, you can talk on the cell phone, you can send a text, right, or shoot off an email to somebody. So while our connections might be more frequent, they may also be shorter and less meaningful. And so we feel like we're always in touch because it's quick and it's easy, and there's maybe many little connections, but maybe not deep and meaningful ones. The government-mandated lockdowns that were said to be necessary to combat COVID have only made matters worse. I didn't take the time to look up the statistics, but suicide and depression is through the roof as a result of the past year. People are alone, and they're isolated, and they're depressed, and they're having difficulties coping. That's just the reality of what's happened in the past year. But it didn't always used to be this way. Our society used to be more interdependent, if I could use that term. We were an agrarian society, you know, mostly farming and agriculture was means of living for most people. They knew the value of friendships, and they depended on each other during difficult times. They weren't waiting for the government to bail them out. They looked to their neighbors for help in times of crisis. They were at each other's homes, you know, or farms, as you will. The family itself worked together. You know, they farmed together. They did everything together. Yeah, you might get up in the morning and go your separate ways to do your chores or duties around the farm, but they were together. They ate in the morning. They'd gather in the evening. It's a value that's been nearly lost in our modern age, and lost along with it are the close bonds and the friendships that are developed as a result of enduring hard times, difficult times, challenges, rejoicing with one another, and, you know, working through trials with each other. I remember an occasion when I worked on a farm. I worked on a farm for a couple summers, and I remember an occasion when, I don't remember the age of the gentleman, I just know he had three little kids, but he died. He was a farmer down the street from the farm I was working at. And I remember being at a meeting where all the farmers in the area got together to meet. I forgot to mention, he died right at harvest time. Worst possible, and there's never a good time, but the worst possible, all that sweat, all that labor, all that money is now out there in the fields, just sitting there. And so all the farmers in the area got together, and they devised a schedule. You know, okay, I'll do my fields from, you know, 5 a.m. till noon, then I'll head down the street, and I'll go, you know, harvest his fields, you know, from noon till midnight. And they all worked out a schedule so that his wife would have income for the year. And all the farmers just, you know, burned their own fuel, used their own tractors, and harvested that man's, I think he had wheat or soybean, if I remember. But they just come up with a plan amongst themselves. They didn't wait for the government to come up with a subsidy or a way of doing things. We have many substitutes for physically gathering together. Social media is probably the most prevailing one. But real face-to-face socializing is what is needed. You know, Facebook and social media and those things is not real socializing. It's a substitute, and a poor one at that. It creates this false sense of belonging. And Facebook even calls them friends, right? And yet, if you were to go down your list, your friends list, as they call it, I think you would agree that it really diminishes what the term, you know, what a true friend really is. You know, I did that a few years ago. I went through my whole thing and just purged it all. And most of them were acquaintances, people I kind of sort of knew. There were some, like, I don't even remember how they ended up on my list. Like, I don't even know the person. So even that has caused us to lose a sense of what that word of friend really means. What is a true friend? In the late 80s, early 90s, there was a TV sitcom titled Cheers. Now, my wife said, I think you may have mentioned this in the past in Mansfield. I had to go back. Yeah, it was like over a decade ago. But it's still a fitting analogy. The show was called Cheers, and the lyrics that began in the beginning of this show said, making your way in the world today. The show's about a bar. You probably remember this, right? Making your way in the world today takes everything you've got. Taking a break from all your worries sure would help a lot. Wouldn't you like to get away? Sometimes you want to go where everybody knows your name, and they're always glad you came. You want to be where you can see. Our troubles are all the same. You want to go where everyone knows your name. That was the opening of that particular show. It's funny because my wife mentioned this last week. I got to look. You know, there's another one I just thought of the other day. Toby Keith has a song out there. I love this bar. And if you've ever heard it, it's just this, oh, I love this bar. And, you know, you can be yourself. And all my friends are here. And they're all weird and different, whatever. But I love this place. And some of you probably have heard that song. I actually like the song. There's nothing probably redeeming qualities about it, but it's a funny song. The sad thing is, these are catchy little tunes, but they're written about bars and not church. Charles Swindoll was once quoted as saying this: the neighborhood bar is possibly the best counterfeit that there is to the fellowship Christ wants us to give his church. It's an imitation, dispensing liquor instead of grace, escape rather than reality. But it is a permissive, accepting, and inclusive fellowship. It is unshockable. It is democratic. You can tell people secrets, and they won't, and they usually don't tell others or even want to, and they probably don't even care about your secrets. He says, the bar flourishes not because most people are alcoholics, but because God has put into the human heart the desire to know and be known, to love and be loved. And so many seek a counterfeit at the price of a few beers. I don't think you could say it any better than what he did. Notice what Solomon wrote in Proverbs 17, verse 17. Proverbs chapter 17 and verse 17, the New King James Version renders it this way: a friend loves at all times, and a brother is born for adversity. Now, the New Living Translation says, a friend is always loyal, and a brother is born to help in a time of need. You know, a true friend is somebody whom, you know, we enjoy mutual affections and interests, and we have respect for one another. The best of friends are the ones that are those helpers to us in times of trouble. There are advocates when we need somebody to help us. They're honest to us, even when we don't want to hear the truth. Right? That's what a true friend is. They're valuable. Through them, we get encouragement. We get consolation when we need it. Fellowship, affirmation, and yes, even at times, correction. A true friend is going to tell you when you're kind of going off track. Let me ask you this question then: who is your friend? And why is friendship important? Join me in John 15. We were having a discussion in council meetings, and this phrase came up, and it had been on my mind ever since then. In the progression of our relationship with God and Jesus Christ, you know, we start, God calls us at some point, right? We're strangers, right? Sojourning in the world, and God calls us to come out of the world. And we start on this path of a relationship. And here in John 15, he explains the importance of our relationship with him. He compares us as branches, and he is the vine. And keep in mind, this is instruction that he's giving to his disciples after Judas, who will betray him, has left the room. So I'll give you the setting. So Judas is not here at this moment. He's already gone out. John 15, verse 1, he says, I am the true vine, and my Father is the vine dresser. Every branch in me that does not bear fruit, he takes away, and every branch that bears fruit, he prunes that it may bear more fruit. You are already clean because of the word which I have spoken to you. Abide in me and I in you, as the branch cannot bear fruit of itself unless it abides in the vine, neither can you unless you abide in me. I am the vine, you are the branches. He who abides in me and I in him bears much fruit, for without me you can do nothing. And so he's speaking of the relationship we have with Jesus Christ. Again, Judas is not here, and I think there's a reason why, because if we drop down a little bit to verse 12, notice what he says here. This is my commandment, that you love one another as I have loved you. Greater love has no one than this, than to lay down one's life for his friends. You are my friends if you do whatever I command you. Verse 15, no longer do I call you servants, for a servant does not know what his master is doing, but I have called you friends. For all things that I heard from my Father, I have made known to you. The first hymn that we sang this morning, coincidentally, I wrote it down, was 112, on the Sabbath day, and it concludes by saying, thanks to God on high, our eternal friend. I want to look at the importance of developing and maintaining true friendships. It seems like such a trivial concept in one regard, because society has trivialized the word. But true friendship is important to God. I don't think it's a small thing that Jesus made a point of saying, I now call you my friends. You know, he calls us at one point, we're strangers to him. And as we develop a relationship, we become disciples, right? And we go from disciples, and that relationship grows to, it gets to a point where here he says, I call you my friend. We want him to call us his friends. So I've simply titled the sermon, True Friendship. We all need friends, but true friendship takes a lot of time and a lot of effort. In the New Testament, there's two words predominantly that are used for friend. It's philos and philia. Are the words that are often used for friendship. Now, you go to the Old Testament, there are two Hebrew words that are at the root of friendship. I can't pronounce either one of them, so I won't. One denotes an association or a type of companionship. The other one implies more of an intimate, deeper relationship. And that's what we want to try to develop. Probably the most well-known example in the Old Testament is that of David and Jonathan. Let's go over to 1 Samuel 18. When we look at friendship in the Bible, this is often one that we tend to go to, 1 Samuel 18. We'll just look at a couple verses. We'll just look at verse 1 for now. Now when he had finished speaking to Saul, the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own soul. That's a phrase that will be used often in describing their relationship. We're going to come back to the story a little bit later in the sermon, but bounce over to 1 Samuel 20 while we're right here, and notice what it says in verse 17. We'll see it used again here. 1 Samuel 20, verse 17. Jonathan again caused David to vow because he loved him, for he loved him as he loved his own soul. So we see this relationship, this friendship is so deep that they have that kind of a relationship one towards another. They love each other as their own soul. That's how close that friendship was. As I said, there's several other occasions in the story of David and Jonathan that uses that same term. We'll come back to them in a little bit. But it's interesting to know, too, that friendship is not limited to human relationships. Right? It's not limited to human relationships. We just sang in the hymn, God, our eternal friend. Notice Exodus 33, 11. And of course, we know, and we're going to look at these examples, Abraham was called a friend of God. So friendship's not limited to just on a physical plane. Exodus 33, verse 11. And so the Lord spoke to Moses face to face as a man speaks to his friend. So it is certainly possible, and something we should be striving for, is to have that type of relationship. We can see this again in 2 Chronicles 20. We'll look at a couple of the locations. 2 Chronicles 20 and verse 7. 2 Chronicles 20 and verse 7. It says here, "Are you not our God who drove out the inhabitants of this land before your people Israel and gave it to the descendants of Abraham, your friend, forever?" So we see this acknowledging this relationship that Abraham had with God as well. And one more location, Isaiah 41, verse 8. Isaiah 41, verse 8. Isaiah chapter 41, verse 8 says, "But you, Israel, are my servant, Jacob, whom I have chosen, the descendants of Abraham, my friend." So again, there are many other locations in Scripture that reinforce the understanding that developing true friendships needs to happen on a physical plane, but ultimately on a spiritual level. We want God to be our friend. We want God and Jesus Christ to view us as their friends. In Ecclesiastes chapter 4, we'll look in, we'll stay here for a few minutes, we'll look at several components that make for true friendships. Ecclesiastes chapter 4. Ecclesiastes chapter 4 and verse 9. Here's a familiar set of verses that my Bible has the heading, "The Value of a Friend." It says, "Two are better than one because they have a good reward for their labor. For if they fall, one will lift up his companion, but woe to him who is alone when he falls, for he has no one to help him up." Again, verse 11, "If two lie down together, they will keep warm, but how can one be warm alone? Though one may be overpowered by another, two can withstand him, and a threefold cord is not quickly broken." And so we'll see several elements here, if I can use that term, ingredients that go into developing true friendships. In verse 9, the first thing we see is that friendship's a good investment. Again, two are better than one because they have a good reward for their labor. What is a reward for our labor but a return on an investment, right? You labor at something, and there's a return for that labor. That we would say that's the return on my investment, what I've put into it. That the words here for good reward can literally be translated a good return or a bountiful return. I never used terms like bountiful return when I was a financial advisor, but we would talk about return on an investment, right? So here we see that the time and energy and effort we put into friendships has a good return on our investment. Now, all investments have risks. I had a little phrase that I had to memorize, and every time you would talk to somebody on investing, you had to give them the whole, "all investments involve risk," and yada, 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 and they would have to kind of agree to that. But all investments have risk. In the case of relationships, one of the biggest risks that we all face is vulnerability. You know, putting yourself out there to become vulnerable. I think we would all agree, as we think about friendships as they develop, we have this point where we kind of put a little something out there to see how it goes, see if that friend repeats it. Yeah, it's a simple thing where it's not like we're doing it deliberately, but vulnerability is a big hurdle in a relationship, and we usually sort of gauge how our friendship is developing by, you know, you might say something to a friend, and if it gets repeated, that's probably where you're going to stop. You're not going to share any more after that because you realize, I'm not sure I can trust this person. But the risk of vulnerability is probably one of the biggest risks in our relationships. And along with that, there's always the challenge of finding yourself maybe putting more into a relationship than you feel is being reciprocated. We don't often flip that around and say, is that person putting more into the relationship than I'm putting into it? You know, that's the other way to look at it, too. Regardless, the very best investment you and I will ever make in life isn't going to be financial ones. It's going to be relationships. Because all of this doesn't go anywhere when we die anyways, right? Character does, relationships do, memories, right? If we spend our entire lives trying to accumulate stuff, we're never going to truly be happy and fulfilled because, as the saying goes, you can't take it with you. Right? I've thought about that more and more as I've ever had to assist people after they've passed away and you're helping somebody clean out a home. We did that with my grandfather when he passed away. My grandmother had preceded him, so my grandfather passed away and there's the house and all his stuff. And you realize all we basically did was just throw out stuff. He couldn't take it with him. And it, you know, a few things had value to family members that we would keep or whatever, but most of it was just stuff. And so again, you realize that. But on the other hand, if we decide to focus on building relationships, that can last for eternity. Those memories, those friendships, those relationships, I don't think those are going to go away. You know, when our final change comes, we become spirit, we can retain all those good memories and those good friendships, and we can have those memories even when physical things go away. In fact, God's whole desire is that we would be masters at building relationships, good, true, solid friendships. Notice Matthew 22. Mr. Klett was speaking about the Pharisees. Here's an example. They were trying to test Jesus with a question, which is the greatest commandment, right? It's a familiar passage, Matthew 22. And notice how he responds to them. You want to know what the greatest commandment is? Here's his response, Matthew 22, beginning in verse 37. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. This is the first and great commandment. What is that? That's a relationship right there. That's a relationship. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. This is the first and great commandment. And the second, verse 39, is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. That's a relationship right there. On these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets. You boil this all down. What is life all about? God wants us to master first a relationship with him, and next relationships with people. And that's why all the other accounts of, you know, how to settle your differences, how, you know, Matthew 18, how to go to a brother, how to deal with offenses, it's all about then tools to help us master relationships, to develop true friendships in this life. Next thing we see back in Ecclesiastes 4, we'll go back there again, Ecclesiastes 4, verse 10. Is that a real friend, a true friend, helps you when you're down. And they provide emotional or physical support if necessary. For if they fall, verse 10, one will lift up his companion. But woe to him who is alone when he falls, for he has no one to help him up. And again, if two lie down together, they will keep warm. How can one be warm alone? So, again, another principle we see here in Ecclesiastes 4 is that a true friend is going to help you when you're down. They're going to give you emotional support. They're going to, you know, physical support even if necessary, but they're going to be there for you. We all have in life, you know, a lot of, you know, I'll use the term acquaintances. You know, we use the term friends so loosely, but friends or acquaintances. But only a very few of them would we call a real, close, true friend. You know, when everything's going wrong, the chips are down, your back's in a corner, who are you going to call? That's the one we're talking of. That one that you know, I don't care what time of the day or night it is, I can call and they're going to answer the phone. It takes a lot of time to develop that type of a friendship. That's the person that when the phone rings, they're probably getting dressed while they're answering because they know, okay, this must be serious. And, you know, they're going to ask, you know, where are you? What can I do? What do you need? Whatever it might be. There's an interesting perspective on this verse here, Ecclesiastes 4:10. In Aramaic, it can be translated, if one of them falls upon the bed and lies sick, the other will cause his friend to rise by prayer. You know, that's how it translates in Aramaic. John Gill states that, quote, a friend, it'll say his friend and brother in a religious community will visit him, will sympathize with him, speak a word of comfort to him, and pray with him. Or if he falls into outward distress, poverty, and want, his friend or friends will distribute to his necessity. If he falls into errors, as a good man may, such as are of the same religious society, with him will take some pains to convince him of the error of his way and convert him from it and to save his soul from death. And they'll cover a multitude of sins. And if he falls into sin, to which the best of men are liable, such as our spiritual will endeavor to restore him in a spirit of meekness. That level of friend. When you start going off the deep end, they're going to try their best to warn you and plead with you and beg you to not go down that path. That kind of a friend. And of course, as John Gill wrote, you know, this phrase covering a multitude of sins is something we've examined before, right? 1 Peter 4:8 references that. We won't go there. It simply says, above all things, have fervent love for one another, for love will cover a multitude of sins. We've examined this in sermons, it's been a few years now. That phrase in 1 Peter is a reference to Proverbs 10:12. Hatred stirs up strife, but love covers all sins. It's that friend that may know you've crossed a line, but they're going to come to you one-on-one because they want you to get back on the right track. And they're there because they love you, that they're not covering up your sin, but they're not making it public. They want to give you a chance to repent and get back on track. That's what that friend does. That's what it means by covering a multitude of sins. It has nothing to do with covering up what you're doing, but it's trying to give that person time to get straightened out and get back on track. And then when they do, nobody else had to know. And, you know, if you have a friend like that, you will appreciate a friend like that who will help you. Notice Proverbs 17. I've mentioned a few Proverbs already, but let's go to Proverbs 17, verse 9. He who covers a transgression seeks love, but he who repeats a matter separates friends. You know, it's that friend who maybe knows you're not doing something right, but rather than starting out by telling everybody else, hey, do you know what so-and-so's doing? They just come right to you and say, look, I know what you're doing. How can I get you back on track? The New Living Translation for Proverbs 17, verse 9 says, love prospers when a fault is forgiven, but dwelling on it separates close friends. Dwelling on it separates close friends. And again, a true friend is that person that when you're facing that battle of a lifetime, how am I going to make it through whatever it is I'm going through right now, that's the one who's going to help you through it. No matter what it takes, they're going to do what they can to help you through it. How many people like that do you have in your life? If you had to reach out to someone right now, how many people do you have like that in your life? Lastly, what we see in Ecclesiastes 4 and verse 12 is a true friend is going to fight to protect you or your reputation. Verse 12, though one may be overpowered by another, two can withstand him, and a threefold cord is not quickly broken. You know, it's interesting when you think about, you know, having a friend that's going to, you know, protect you or your reputation. If you've ever watched movies or seen documentaries that depict combat strategy of ancient times, before the tools of modern warfare, when combat was hand-to-hand, one of the things that you'll notice, because it was hand-to-hand, is you're very vulnerable to your backside. because you can't see what's happening behind you. You're fighting, you know, hand to hand right in front of you. Soldiers would go into battle with a partner, somebody they could count on without a doubt. And they would go into battle and they would stand back to back. And they would touch their backs together so that you knew he was still there. Like you couldn't be looking over your shoulders. You had to know he was there. And so they pressed their backs against one another as they battled. And you battled what you could see, and you trusted him to have your back. That's where the phrase came from. He had your back, and you had his back. And you would trust that he wouldn't stab you in the back. Right? And that's how warfare handled. So you see where all these phrases have come about that we use today. They would guard each other's back. Right? So you see where all this, you know, really came from. That person covered your back, guarded your back, wouldn't stab you in the back. They had your back. If you were to go into that type of warfare, you would definitely want that level of companionship, that you wouldn't have any doubt. But can you be that for someone else? Right? Because that person, true, they're counting on you as well. Like, you know, we think in terms of what we want. I definitely want somebody to guard my back, watch my back, won't stab me in the back. But the converse is true. Can that other person depend on you in the same manner? Can you be that level of friend? And that's why, you know, those levels of friendships are often, you don't have a lot of them. Because there's a lot involved to get to that point of a relationship. There's a lot of, you know, as you say, water under the bridge that happens in a friendship. You know, when you think about some of your closest friends, when I think about some of mine, you know, I can maybe remember the first time we met. But I didn't meet with, oh, we're going to become the best of friends. I can just tell right now. It's just all, it's like one of those things you look back and you go, I you know, when I first met them, I didn't know that their friendship would become what it is today. It's just, but you go through a lot. And so we see here in Ecclesiastes these elements of true friendship, that it's a good investment. They're going to help you when you're down. They're going to provide comfort in times of need, and they're going to be there to support you. And they're going to fight to protect you and defend you and be there for you. So again, we should look for that in others, and we want to be that for others. Let's go back to 1 Samuel 18 now. Let's go back to the story of David and Jonathan and look quickly through some of the highlights we see there. There are several things in this books of 1 and 2 Samuel, different themes that flow through them, but one of them is the life of David, you know, this man after God's own heart. And we'll see that, you know, as you read all of 1 and 2 Samuel, we'll see his triumphs and his tragedies, his highs and his lows. But we see this relationship between David and Jonathan as we pick it up in verse 17. We'll pick up verse 18. In chapter 17 is when David slew Goliath. So we're jumping into this point of his life after that event occurred. And one of the things that we're going to see here, first off, is how extraordinary this relationship is. Because Jonathan, by all, you know, in modern vernacular, is royalty, right? He doesn't have to make friends with anybody because he's son of the king and he's next in line. So he could pretty much, you know, you would think, in modern day thinking, do what he wants. Doesn't have to make friends with anybody. So to have this level of relationship is truly extraordinary. 1 Samuel 18, verse 1, when he had finished speaking to Saul, the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own soul. You know, so here's somebody who's in line to be king who isn't going to be threatened by David. Verse 2, Saul took him that day and would not let him go home to his father's house anymore. Then Jonathan and David made a covenant because he loved him as his own soul. There's that term. It'll be used often in their relationship. And Jonathan took off the robe that was on him and gave it to David with his armor, even his sword and his bow and his belt. So here's somebody who's not going to be threatened by the relationship. I mean, imagine you're next in line, you would think, to be king, and your dad is really developing this relationship with this other guy. And today, the way people are, that wouldn't last long, right? Ship them off to the Isle of Patmos and make them disappear or whatever. But we don't see that in this friendship that they have. And so the first principle we see here in their relationship is that friends love one another as themselves. That's what it said in verse 1. He loved him as himself. That is a true friend. You know, that means when we look at our friends, we treat our friends the way we would want to be treated, right? And we have that level of commitment towards one another. You know, when Jesus spoke those words to love your neighbor as yourself in Matthew 22, he was actually quoting from Leviticus 19. Let's go to, we'll come right back here, Leviticus 19, 18. Leviticus chapter 19 and verse 18. It says, you shall not take vengeance nor bear any grudge against the children of your people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord. That's what he was referencing. You want to know how to love your neighbor as yourself? Read all of Leviticus 19 from like 9 down, beginning of verse 9 down to 18. We won't for sake of time, but there's several principles in there about if you want to know what it means to love your neighbor as yourself. He gives a lot of principles right there. We saw that in Jonathan and David's relationship. He loved him as himself, treated him the way he would want to be treated. And so, how well do we do that to our friends? The next principle we see is that they are committed to one another. We see in 1 Samuel 18, verse 3, Jonathan and David made a covenant because he loved him as his own soul. Now, we don't make covenants today. We do make commitments to one another. You know, a true friend is, whether implicit or clearly stated, you want to know they've got your back. That's usually when friendships break down, is when you feel betrayed, right? You thought you could depend on that person, and whatever occurred, you suddenly feel like they broke a trust, we don't use the term covenant, but you feel like something of that magnitude was severed in this relationship. And that's often what causes our friendships to break down. But we see this phrase again repeated often in their relationship about loving one another as himself. So again, that's the principle. They're not fair-weather friends. They're going to be there for you. And it's people that we can count on. Remember back in Ecclesiastes 4 and verse 10, we read that if one would fall, they would lift up his companion. But woe to the one who falls alone. Same principle, right? You need to know that you have that commitment to each other. They're going to be there for you and watch out for you. So here again, we see in verse 13, it says, Jonathan and David made a covenant. It just simply means, you know, in a modern day sense, we're committed to one another through thick or thin. You know, how true are you or how committed are you to your true friends? A little later, let's jump over to chapter 20 quickly. I won't spend much time there, but notice what it says here in 1 Samuel 20, verse 4, because notice what Jonathan says here. Jonathan said to David, verse 4, 1 Samuel 20, whatever you yourself desire, I'll do it for you. It's a good test question for your relationship with a friend. How committed are you one to another? Would you do anything legal and appropriate, we'll put that in there. Would you do anything legal and appropriate for your friend? Or are there limits? Right? And it's a good way to gauge your friendships. We'll go back to chapter 19 now. We're going to kind of move forward from verse 18, but notice 1 Samuel 19, verse 1 and 2, we'll see another principle. And that is about looking out for one another. Now Saul spoke to Jonathan, his son, and to all his servants that they should kill David. But Jonathan, Saul's son, delighted greatly in David. And so Jonathan told David, saying, my father Saul seeks to kill you. Therefore, please be on your guard until morning and stay in a secret place and hide. How much time do we spend looking out for the interests of our friends, as opposed to just our own interests? I mean, here Jonathan is looking out for David when he realizes that his father seeks to kill him. Do we care about the problems our friends are facing? Right? Do we reach out and inquire, how are you doing? It's been a while since you spoke about whatever it is, and so I'm just, you know, how are you doing? Can I, you know, are you getting through it? Is there something I can help you with? Or, you know, another way to turn that around is, do you speak up when you see a problem? You know, in our youth, I certainly have occasions in my youth when we may have had a friend who was being picked on in school or in the neighborhood or church. I'll give you an example of that here in a moment. And yet you kind of felt like if I speak up, the only thing that's going to happen is then I'm going to get picked on. And so you pretend you didn't see it so you don't have to speak up about it. Now, oftentimes, that's just immaturity. A lot of times it happens when you're young because you just don't know how to handle it, and it's just immaturity. I remember an occasion, I've had occasions like that in school. I remember one in church. We had a particular individual who was the basketball coach, and every year somebody became his GOAT. And it didn't mean greatest of all time like it does today. It means you're the one I'm going to kick. And he would just ride that person it made their life miserable to the point where some would just quit. They would just quit basketball because they hated going to practice because the coach was just that. It was just one of those deals where it became obvious. You could tell this was the guy going to get picked on all season. And I remember giving him my 2 cents, and then I ended up going to the pastor, you know, and say, look, this is what's going on. And the pastor didn't do anything about it. You know, and my friend after that year just quit playing basketball after that. Just wasn't going to put up with it anymore. So these things do happen. As I said, a lot of times as kids in our youth, we struggle with what to do, and so sometimes we do nothing. A lot of that, I just say, is just immaturity, right? You weren't ready to handle it. But adults do it at times too. You know, maybe if I speak up at work, maybe I'll start getting the boss's wrath, so I'll just kind of not say anything, even though we know I probably should say something. Right? I know I had my run-ins back with my former employer when I was in Michigan that I knew it wouldn't be long and I'd be gone because I just couldn't let him do the things that he was doing, and I would tell him, and he didn't like it. I tried to be nice about it, but it is what it is. Matthew 26, we see even some of our beloved characters of the Bible made these mistakes as well. Peter responded in a similar fashion when Jesus told him that he would deny him. And, of course, we know the story. Peter said, oh, I'm not going to deny you. Everybody else might deny you, but I'm not going to deny you. Matthew 26, we see what happened. Beginning verse 69, now Peter sat outside in the courtyard, and a servant girl came to him, saying, you also were with Jesus of Galilee. But he denied it before them all, saying, I do not know what you're talking about or what you're saying. And we had gone out to the gateway. Another girl saw him and said to those who were there, this fellow also was with Jesus of Nazareth. Now, of course, Peter's probably thinking, you know, if they find out I'm with him, I might end up in the same fate, right? And so, but again, he denied with an oath, I do not know the man. And a little later, those who stood by came up and said to Peter, surely you also are one of them, for your speech betrays you. And then he began to curse and swear, saying, I do not know the man. And immediately a rooster crowed. And Peter remembered the word of Jesus who said to him, before the rooster crows, you'll deny me 3 times. So he went out and he wept bitterly. He denied his friend. Jesus said, I call you my friend. And he denied knowing his friend. You know, and so when he realized that, it says he went out and he wept bitterly. Have you ever let a friend down? Have we ever let a friend down? Right. Another principle in 1 Samuel 19, verses 4 and 5, we don't have to turn back there, is that friends rejoice. Well, yeah, let's go there. 1 Samuel 19, verse 4. They rejoice when their friends succeed. You know, that's something that we should be willing to do. You know, if your friend gets a promotion, they get a new car, whatever it might be, when they succeed, we should just rejoice with them. right? And not be envious of them. 1 Samuel 19, verse 4. Thus Jonathan spoke well of David, right? He spoke well of David to Saul, his father, and said to him, "Let not the king sin against his servant, against David, because he has not sinned against you, and because his works have been very good toward you. For he took his life in his hands and killed the Philistine, and the Lord brought about a great deliverance for all Israel. You saw it and rejoiced. Why then will you sin against innocent blood to kill David without a cause?" So here, you know, it's about rejoicing and defending him at the same time. You know, the Apostle Paul's letter to the church in Rome, he writes about the remarks of a true Christian. And in Romans 12:15, you can put this in your notes. He says to rejoice with those who rejoice and weep with those who weep. You know, we should be able to just truly rejoice when something great happens to our friend and not get envious or jealous or, you know, just rejoice. Something good happened for them and be happy for them. Now for a quick warning or two as we begin to wind down. Friendships also have dangers, right? Because some, and I'll put this one, friends in quotations, can give bad advice. They can double cross us. They can go off the path that leads to eternal life and want to drag you along with them, right? Deuteronomy 13, verse 6. Deuteronomy 13, beginning verse 6, it says, "If your brother, the son of your mother, your son or your daughter, the wife of your bosom, or your friend who is as your own soul," where have we heard that term before? Right? That's how David and Jonathan spoke of each other, as my own soul. That really close, tight, true friend secretly entices you, saying, "Let us go and serve other gods, which you have not known, neither you nor your fathers, of the gods of the people which are all around you, near to you or far off from you, from one end of the earth to the other end of the earth, you shall not consent to him or listen to him. Nor shall you, your eye, pity him, nor shall you spare him or conceal him." You know, we all have to choose our friends very carefully. And we can't let our guard down because, again, the term that's used here in Deuteronomy 13:6 is the friend who is as your own soul. This is how Jonathan and David were described. So even a true friend may make a wrong turn and try to entice you to go with them. And as sad and as painful as that may be, that's the time when you have to say no. Many of you did this, right? 95 was an occasion where I'm sure many people had to say no to really close friends. And it happened again a decade ago, right? That we had to say no to people that we looked at as friends, close friends. We broke bread together. We sweated together working on projects or whatever. It was, you know, all these memories of time spent together. And you had to say no to them because they're deciding to go off in a different direction. You know, Proverbs features the most references to friendship in the Bible. Yet many of them caution against the dangers of unhealthy friendships. Most of those references are the dangers of picking wrong friends and ones that are shallow or disingenuous. I'll give you a couple. Proverbs 19:6 says, "Many entreat the favor of the nobility, and every man is a friend to one who gives gifts." Right. So here we're speaking of shallow, being bought off type of stuff. So there's a warning against that. Proverbs 12:26 says, "The righteous should choose his friends carefully, for the way of the wicked leads them astray." In James 4, verse 4, it says, "Adulterers and adulteresses, do you know that friendship with the world is enmity with God? Whoever therefore wants to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God." You know, again, the Bible is full of many admonitions and instructions and encouragements on how to develop true friendships, but it gives us just as many warnings against being careful who you spend your time with. Because someone that you might even consider a close friend could, whether deliberately or unintentionally, lead you astray. And we have to be careful of that as well. And of course, a key scripture you can put in your notes that we all probably know by heart is Proverbs 18:24, that reminds us a man who has friends must himself be friendly, but there is a friend that sticks closer than a brother. And the principle there is that true friendship is reciprocal. Right? It's mutual. It goes both ways. In Proverbs 18:24, I sometimes think, you know, it might be better said, a man who wants to have friends must first be friendly. Put yourself out there. Meet people. You know, one of our boys, when he was little tiny, was the one that would, you know, he was the one we had to strap in the cart when we went grocery shopping, because he'd walk up to a stranger, "Hi, can we be friends?" And every person he met was his friend. Like, "Oh, I just met a friend." It's like, you know, but it, you know, that's the beauty of the innocence of children, right? That, you know, if I meet you, until you prove otherwise, you're my friend, right? So the immediate position is, we're friends unless you let me down. As we get older, it's like, yeah, I'm not so sure you're going to be my friend yet. You got to work on it, right? It's amazing how life jades us, I guess. But yeah, that one out of the boys was the one more than the other. Yeah, go grocery shopping, you get strapped in the cart because they probably just go wandering off. Anyways, as I said in the beginning of the sermon, you know, we are living at a time when we think we're more connected than we really are. We have more opportunities to connect, in a sense, but we're not maybe developing the deep, meaningful, true friendships and relationships that I think God wants us to have. I think this last year has made it even worse, as we've been so isolated from one another, and that's why, you know, you've heard me say enough times, I've been pushing for us to try to be together as much as we can and get back to whatever normal, you know, how we're going to define that, but, you know, to have services, to have food, to stay around, to fellowship, to get together, be together, because we need it. We really do need it. We have many substitutes today for physically gathering together. Again, I've mentioned them, social media and texting and chatting and, of course, video conference. I am tired of video conferences. Man, I'm tired of those things. I've had too many of them, and they get frustrating because you spend more time, you know, can you unmute your mic? Oh, yeah, I forgot. Sorry. It's like, how many have been in video chats where it's like there's somebody keeps forgetting to unmute their mic, or then you got to tell them that, no, now you need to mute your mic because we can hear you talking to you, whatever. It's like, it's just frustrating. But all of this connections that we have creates a false sense of belonging, but it diminishes the actual, true, deep, meaningful relationships that we need to have and we need to develop. And those only come from spending time together. You know, rubbing shoulders, working on a project, you know, and all that goes along with it. Remember, Jesus said, greater love has no one than this, than one would lay down his life for his friends. And he said, you are my friends if, what did he say? You do what I command you. If you do that, you're my friend. That's exactly what he told us in John 15. And so we've seen then that true friendship is reciprocal. And so I ask the question, is Jesus your friend? He gave us the criteria, you are my friend if you do as I command you. So am I his friend? Am I doing what he commands me to do? I'm going to go back to that Cheers intro that I shared with you. Because again, I can't help but appreciate that it should actually apply to a church and not a bar. I'll go through those words again. Making your way in the world today takes everything you've got, because we're not of this world. That's why it takes every ounce of what we got, right? We're not of this world. John 17 tells us that. Taking a break from all your worries sure would help a lot. He gives us the Sabbath day just for that purpose. You don't need a bar. Wouldn't you like to get away? Sometimes you want to go where everybody knows your name and they're always glad you came. This should be that place where we're always glad we came. You want to be where you can see our troubles are all the same. Ecclesiastes 1:9, there's nothing new under the sun. Our trials may be different, but we all have trials, right? The Bible, it's so clear on this. And that's why every time I hear that jingle, I think that should be a church, not a bar, right? You want to go where everyone knows your name. Again, we have to come together to stir up love and good works, as I've kind of hammered a lot on Hebrews 10:24. That's the why. That's why we come here. But we need to come together to stir up that love and good works while it is still possible for us to come together. I don't know when a time will come when we can't. Yeah, I shared what I did in the announcements because look at how much changed in a couple months. They're banning Dr. Seuss books now. I've got a couple of those. I looked online. One of them's the guy's trying to sell on eBay for $4,000. If he sells his, I'm selling mine, right? Right? They've banned 5 Dr. Seuss books. They haven't banned them. The publisher's just not going to make them anymore. So in essence, they've accomplished the same thing. Our world is changing rapidly. I don't know how long we can be together, but we need to be together as long as we can. That I do know. So we've got to come together, stir up love and good works, not forsaking the assembling together. And of course, the 2 great commandments are about true, meaningful, lasting relationships. The first is with God, and the second is with people, with one another, because Jesus has called us his friends.